Hello and welcome to the 24th episode of Nations of Charlemagne, Exporting the French Revolution. How I've set up for this episode, the 24th episode, is to divide this into three parts and a bonus part. There will be a lecture on exporting the French Revolution to Italy, exporting the French Revolution to Germany, which also coincides with the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire and the configuration of a new Napoleonic order. There will be a bonus episode only for members on Sunday covering the Peninsular War in Spain, of course. And on Monday, there will be a discussion revolving around the background of this topic, but also focusing more on some of the martial aspects of this period. So focusing on some key Napoleonic battles. And I'm going to have a few people on: Columba, Marcus Aurelius Pertinax, Panama Hat, to delve deeper into the Napoleonic period from a angle of military history. Going into this topic, this has been a difficult one for me to organize, simply because with the previous arrangements and lectures that I've organized for Nations of Charlemagne, there, of course, has been a German lecture, a German episode, or focusing on the rise of Prussia, German dualism, which took us up until 1780. And there, of course, was a French episode focusing on particularly the reign of Louis XV and the Ancien Régime in France, really taking us all the way up until the calling of the Estates General before the French Revolution. But no such video on Italy existed, almost because the history of Italy in the 18th century alone prior to the revolution didn't justify an episode in its own right. So here I'm going to try and combine a would-be episode on Italian history in the 18th century, referring back to some older lectures, going back to the Tridentine Era lecture and the War of Spanish Succession lecture, to try and tie this in to understanding the political historical context before we arrive at the Napoleonic invasion of Italy in 1796. So to quickly bring everyone up to speed, because unfortunately in English language history, there is a huge absence after the French Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance, all the way up until the Risorgimento, which is, and of course, even the Napoleonic period of Italian history is focusing almost purely on the biography of Napoleon, as opposed to how the Napoleonic French Revolutionary Administration was actually implemented into Italy and what the effect of this was. So in order to get everyone up to speed, we have the Italian Wars, which end in 1559 and establish Spanish Habsburg hegemony over Italy. Combine that with the Council of Trent, and we have the Tridentine Era, in which the papacy and the Spanish monarchy in Italy is exporting the cultural effects of the Counter-Reformation, which I prefer to call the Tridentine period, the Mannerist movements, the Baroque art movements, and of course, the Tridentine reform decrees throughout the Catholic Church all across the world. That combined with the creation of the Jesuit order. However, this period begins to unravel. You have a major sort of outpouring of artistic and intellectual brilliance in the latter half of the 16th century, in the earlier part of the 17th century. Then as Spain begins to decline, gets embroiled in the 80 Years' War with Holland and the 30 Years' War against France and her allies in the Holy Roman Empire and Sweden, all of a sudden, we see a major cultural and political shift away from Italy, which had been the dominant, if not the dominant political power, then definitely the dominant cultural power in Europe throughout the 15th and 16th centuries. And I think almost like the perfect manifestation of what I'm talking about is when Tommaso Campanella, one of the great thinkers of this period, transfers his allegiance from Philip IV of Spain, who by extension also controls a significant amount of Italy, and he transfers his allegiance to the young Louis XIV in France just before his death, conferring on France the mantle of universal monarchy. And thereafter, France, from the remainder of the 17th century and the 18th century, becomes the standard bearer of continental European civilization, and of course a major political power, which Italy never was in its own right. Combine this with the aspect that France is becoming more powerful and the Spanish Empire is declining, we see the cataclysmic struggle from 1701 to 1714, the slide which I have up currently, focusing on the War of Spanish Succession. For the purpose of this conversation, all you need to know is that the Spanish possessions in Italy were taken over by the Austrian branch of the family in the House of Habsburg. However, this led to a very unhappy situation where you have a Bourbon king put on the throne of Spain, who also has various claims to the throne of France due to a succession crisis, which is currently happening in the French monarchy due to the fact that Louis XIV's heirs quickly predecease him. Both his son and his grandson predecease him very quickly from 1711 through to 1712. And here we have the dawn of a new system in Italy, which I'm going to provisionally call Italian dualism to try and reflect back on the earlier lecture focusing on German dualism, but just in terms of outlining this new order in Italy that takes over the situation post-1559 up until 1701. We see the rise of the Savoyard monarchy. They acquire possession of Sicily, and then later that's transferred to Sardinia. So the Dukes of Savoy, the rulers of Piedmont, become also the kings of Sardinia. Austria, for a brief amount of time, holds on to southern Italy, Sicily and Naples, and of course the centre of their power in Milan. But as a result of a dramatic shift in French foreign policy towards supporting the Spanish Bourbons under Cardinal Fleury during the regency of Louis XV, we begin to see the iteration of a new French policy, the Pacte de Famille, really exploiting the political after effects of the War of Spanish Succession, which couldn't be immediately felt because the new king of Spain, Philip V, had a direct claim on the French throne. So there was this ludicrous period in history where France and Britain actually ally against Spain to prevent Philip V becoming king of both France and Spain. Nevertheless, in the tumult that ensues from this, we have this figure on the right, Elizabeth Farnese, who brings back her family, the Farnese family, which had been a mainstay in Italian politics, papal politics, the Duchy of Parma, etc. And she is able to become Queen of Spain, but she's also able to place one of her sons on the throne of Parma. And then he goes south, and during a struggle, which again is neither here nor there for this lecture, the War of Polish Succession, this young Charles de Bourbon, Charles of Parma, conquers southern Italy from the Habsburgs and establishes, after the Battle of Bitonto, which really confirms this, after the Treaty of Vienna in 1738, a new system of Italian dualism. This new Italian order would endure on the peninsula for 50 years, despite Italy's relative decline, both in terms of its economy and its geostrategic significance compared to Germany, France, England, and Russia. And of course, in terms of why this is, we can talk about the Atlantic shift moving towards intercontinental trade, talking about the rise in France of mercantilism, then of course the rise of modern sort of trading and commercialism and banking, of course, in the Netherlands, and then, of course, later in Great Britain and the United States. And all of these commercial enterprises, which have been so intimately associated with Italy during its height of its power in the 15th century, are moving away towards the north. And these are going to be the states which really establish themselves as the great new global powers, while Italy is left behind. As for Italy itself, though, the Habsburgs, the Austrians, controlled Lombardy and Tuscany in the north, while the Bourbons controlled the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies and Parma after a brief Habsburg reign from 1735 until 1748. From 1706 to 1796, Lombardy, or the Duchy of Milan, was the centre of Austrian power in Italy, having previously served as the northern seat of the Spanish Habsburgs since Philip II of Spain in the second half of the 16th century. Tuscany, or the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, emerged as a major Italian power in the 16th century, centering on a junior branch of the famous Medici family. None of these Medici, by the way, were in any way related to Cosimo or Lorenzo il Magnifico. This was a junior family which was actually detested by the sole survivor of the main branch, Catherine de' Medici, who became Queen Consort of France and later a principal actor during the French Wars of Religion. Tuscany was once a fief of the emperor in Austria and of the Spanish kingdom. Essentially, it was It was essentially the power was divided. It owed allegiance to both Habsburgs in Austria and Spain. And this was essential for the continued power of the Habsburgs in Italy. And yet, Tuscany, in its own right, was sufficiently powerful to exert itself as a power. Tuscany reached its zenith under Cosimo II, with Tuscany boasting a vibrant scientific and artistic center, coupled with a strong navy and army. Though Cosimo II is chiefly remembered for his patronage of Galileo Galilei, and of course, everything which happens to him as a result of his interaction with the Inquisition. Thereafter, as with the rest of Italy, Tuscany entered into a period of decline in the second half of the 17th century, though the decline in Tuscany was perhaps the most profound, owing to the protracted tyrannical rule and fiscal mismanagement of the penultimate Medici Grand Duke, Cosimo III. By the end of the War of Spanish Succession, Florence was a ghost town. The population of the duchy had declined by 40%, the armed forces were ramshackle, and the state was bankrupt. As a succession crisis loomed, Cosimo III briefly flirted with the idea of the restoration of the old Florentine Republic before the Tuscan succession became a central concern for perpetuating Habsburg power throughout the north. As part of a dynastic contrivance involving the Polish War of Succession and the French designs on Lorraine, which again have been referenced previously and for this conversation, neither here nor there. The later Holy Roman Emperor, Francis I, and the husband of Mary Theresa of Austria, became the Grand Duke of Tuscany. Thereafter, Tuscany became a possession of the new Habsburg-Lorraine imperial dynasty, though Francis himself had little interest in Italian affairs, residing mostly in Vienna. Juxtaposing this Habsburg apathy, and indeed the peril of the Habsburgs in Italy as they faced the War of Austrian Succession from 1740 to 1748, was this new Bourbon Farnese dynasty in the south. Having conquered Naples and Sicily, and having those conquests recognized in 1738, Charles of Bourbon, King of Naples, Sicily, and of Jerusalem, resisted attempts to join his Bourbon father and cousin in Spain and France in their war against the Austrians, fearing that his grip over the kingdom was too tenuous to risk a foreign adventure. In the end, Charles was provoked into this conflict as Mary Theresa and the Austrians attempted to overthrow Charles with the backing of Austrian royalists from the reign of her father, who was also at one point the King of Naples and Sicily. Entering the war, Charles defeated the Austrians decisively at the Battle of Velletri and won for his brother the core Farnese possession of Parma. By 1748, a system of Italian dualism was secured under the houses of Bourbon Farnese or Bourbon Parma and Habsburg Lorraine. As the first Neapolitan and Sicilian nationalist to rule as sovereign in 250 years, Charles established a system of enlightened despotism, aiming to centralize the kingdom and diminish the power of the Catholic Church, and imitating France through his projection of royal soft power through the construction of the Palace of Caserta. Despite this new system of Italian dualism, the two Sicilies never boasted a great army or threatened Habsburg power to amount to an Italian Prussia on the lines of a restored kingdom of Frederick II Stupa Mundi, who ruled the southern Italian possessions, both Sicily and the territory of Naples, from his capital in Palermo as Holy Roman Emperor. Charles repeatedly resisted attempts to attack Austria, despite British prompting during the Seven Years' War, though to do so would have been incredibly foolhardy given the diplomatic revolution of 1756. Bear in mind that after hundreds of years of enmity between the Habsburgs and France, in 1756, to deal with the threat of Prussia and Great Britain, for the first time, the French and the Austrians form an alliance, and this is the diplomatic revolution of 1756, or what Frederick the Great of Prussia would refer to as the League of the Three Petticoats, because it also involved Madame de Pompadour, the maîtresse en titre of the of Louis the 15th, and of course the Empress Elizabeth of Russia. Nevertheless, if you think about this in the context of there being both Bourbons and Habsburgs ruling over a large section of Italy, if anything, the 1756 diplomatic revolution acted as the best possible guarantee of this new political status quo in Italy. All the remarkable again, considering that the Habsburgs and Capetians had fought over domination of Italy for centuries, and now they are in this happy equilibrium. In 1759, with the death of his half-brother in Spain, Charles became the King of Spain as Charles III and bequeathed his Italian realm to his younger son Ferdinand, who, beginning his reign at the age of 8, would rule the Sicilies uneventfully for the next 30 years. Indeed, he would be deposed several times when a revolution comes, and he will be restored after the fall of Napoleon to indicate the longevity of the new King Ferdinand IV. Two younger sons of Mary Theresa and Emperor Francis, Peter Leopold and the younger Ferdinand, would come to rule over Tuscany, Milan and Modena, establishing personal Habsburg rule in these states for the first time. Peter Leopold found Tuscany ruined by over a century of mismanagement and attempted to transform the region into a Habsburg asset, establishing a benign system of government that banned the use of torture and even the death penalty, in line with the principles of the Enlightenment. In that vein, he even attempted a dramatic transformation of the duchy's legal and political system, in line with the revolutionaries in America, only to be opposed by all the conventional orders of Tuscany. Both he and his elder brother Joseph II, the Holy Roman Emperor in Austria, attempted and failed to reconstitute their realms as enlightened despots. If you want to know more about Joseph II, I have several videos on him on this channel, focusing on the Austrian side of history. Nevertheless, there was an incremental material improvement in Tuscany over Peter Leopold's 20-year reign. Shortly after the storming of the Bastille, Joseph II died, leaving Leopold as the new Holy Roman Emperor, though he was reluctant to abandon his Italian rule, having become emotionally attached and affectionate towards his Italian subjects, even though he was never particularly popular. Archduke Ferdinand, however, would remain in Milan as its governor until Napoleon's conquest of Milan in 1796. Other than the Italian minor states, like the d'Este possession of Modena, that would also come under the Habsburgs, and later the Habsburg d'Este family, there was Savoy, Sardinia, Piedmont, the Papal States, Venice, and Genoa. For reference, this may sound very confusing as I'm moving along with this, Sardinia, Piedmont, and Savoy are all used interchangeably. Some people even insist on calling it Savoy, Sardinia, Piedmont to make it all the more confusing. But in terms of my understanding of the dynasty of Savoy, Savoy is equivalent to, say, Habsburg for the Austrians. And given that the actual locus of power for this state would change, I think just referring to them as Savoy or the Savoyards, regardless of the fact that Savoy is going to be lost to this state very soon after the French invade, is the easiest way to communicate what this state is. So I will be opting for Savoy, not Sardinia or Piedmont, though I will be referring to these regions as geographic entities and not political entities. Savoy, therefore, remained a stalwart Austrian ally after the Spanish War of Succession, and played a minor but significant role in the Austrian War of Succession, being the ultimate mediators of peace and preventing the French annexation of Savoy proper and Nice. And just for reference, Savoy is the territory around Chambéry where we have Mont Blanc and the French Alps, just north of the city of Turin, which has now become the capital of the state of Savoy. Under Charles Emanuele III, Savoy was wealthy, the monarchy was powerful, while the state possessed one of the best armies in Italy. As the protector of Italy's Alpine frontier, Savoy sided with the Austrians against the French in 1792. The Papal States, the domains of the Church, remained a major regional Italian power, while acting in defence of the worldwide Catholic Church, of course Catholic literally means universal, and enforcing the Tridentine decrees emanating from the original Council of Trent in the first half of the 16th century. Under the pontificate of Innocent XI, the Church became the leader and principal proponent of the Holy League, which spearheaded resistance to the Ottoman Empire after 1683, the Great Turkish War, perhaps the last Great Crusade. After 1699, and confirmed by 1718, the Ottoman Empire declined as a threat to the integrity of Christendom and indeed Italy. Afterwards, the threat to the Catholic Church came from the secularizing impulses of the Enlightenment and many nominally Catholic monarchs who championed it. The Church was not hostile to this new era of scientific discovery, perhaps best encapsulated by the Pope polymath Benedict XIV and founder of what would later become the Vatican Museum, focused here in this fantastic portrait in the center, while remaining faithful to the Tridentine reform. As new rulers consolidated their realms across the Italian peninsula, Charles of Naples, under his liberal minister Tanucci, targeted church lands while attempting to abolish Naples as a de jure papal fief, a situation, if you recall, going all the way back to the 11th century. The most fierce defenders of papal prerogatives, the Jesuit order, came under attack by various rulers using the Enlightenment as a pretext to extend their authority over these respective national churches rather than the church as a whole entity. This began in Portugal and then the Bourbon kingdoms of France and Spain. And of course, during this time, the papacy, which was in decline, did not possess the temporal authority to resist this international pressure from Catholic secularizing monarchs. And under the influence of Clement XIV, the papacy actually facilitated the suppression of the Jesuits in 1773. Under Pope Pius VI, the Papal States resisted pressure from the Holy Roman Emperor Joseph II to radically transform the nature of ecclesiastical appointments and effectively bring this idea of Gallicanism, i.e. the idea that the king is responsible for the appointment of the bishops and that you have a special status or privilege for the French Church or the French Catholic Church. There is this idea emanating in the late 18th century of expanding this idea of Gallicanism, and Joseph II wants to bring about this idea and implement it in Austria. The idea of the primacy of the national churches of Catholicism at the expense of the Pope is called Febronianism, after the Enlightenment tracts of one von Hontheim, who took on the epithet of Febronian, and he was operating out of Mainz in Germany. Peter Leopold of Tuscany went further in his attempt to reform the church with the Synod of Pistoia. And this, of course, happening in Tuscany, was adjacent right to the center of papal power. In response, Pius VI issued the bull Auctorum Fidei, defending the universal church against this wave of Febronianism. Faced with the revolution in France from 1789, the church found itself without the Jesuits to counter the revolutionaries. An attempt by Pius to restore the order to explicitly defend Catholicism against the revolution failed, after which the French deposed Louis XVI and proclaimed a republic. From the outset of the 18th century, Venice appeared to be on the verge of a new political renaissance. For the previous two centuries, Venetian, Genoese, and Spartan maritime power had been essential in checking the expansion of the Ottoman Empire. Despite the fall of that of Venetian Crete, with the Ottoman defeat in the Great Turkish War, Venice, as an integral member of the Holy League, expanded her influence into Albania, solidifying her Adriatic possessions in Dalmatia while acquiring the Morea, the modern-day Peloponnese. And this, of course, if you think about the geography, acts as a potential springboard to create a new Venetian Greek empire. Despite this temporary growth of the possessions of the Stato di Mar, the state of the sea, within two decades, all of this territory except Dalmatia was lost to the Republic. The Ottomans continued to fail against Austria, briefly losing Belgrade, but the Ottomans were able to successfully dislodge the Venetians from Greece and Albania, save for the old Venetian fortress in Corfu. A decade later, the Ottomans were even able to push back against the Austrians themselves, denying any possibility of an Austrian conquest of the Balkans. The Venetians, feeling betrayed by their Austrian allies, the fact they did not help them in their conflict, and Austria was able to reap the gains of a previous war from 1716 to 1718, and the Venetians virtually lost all of their territory, forced the Venetians into a state of political neutrality. They remained neutral even up until the invasion of the French Republic in 1796. The Republic prospered internally from this peace, while the rest of Europe was engrossed in conflict, for Venice known as a period of the Venetian peace. And of course, the 18th century is one of the most bellicose periods of European history, constant wars throughout France, the New World and Germany. Despite the prosperity of the Republic, the Stato di Mar played no role in her policymaking. Venice was no longer concerned with expanding maritime power. It was no longer concerned even with the maintenance of a galley fleet. And after about 1795, what's more remarkable is that when Napoleon actually attacks and delivers ultimatum to Venice, the Venetians simply do not have a navy and they do not have an army for which to stymie the French advance. As such, by the 1790s, Venice, having been one of Italy's most formidable states, became a no man's land in the heart of Europe, a place for intrigue, commerce, and pleasure. The decline of Genoa was more dramatic. Unlike the Venetians, the Genoese were embroiled in a series of conflicts against the Piedmontese, who now surrounded their territory. The French, the Austrians, and the Barbary states of North Africa also attacked the Republic from all sides. Already, Genoa had undergone decline as a banking and trading centre. By the 1740s, Genoa had lost the last vestiges of her overseas empire in North Africa and was now facing a protracted guerrilla war in Corsica, which had escalated into a struggle for Corsican independence. The Corsican Republic established Italy's first revolutionary government. Pasquale Paoli, having driven out the Genoese in the 1750s, establish a representative government, a diet, with universal male suffrage for all men above the age of 25, prior to both the American and the French revolutions, and ostensibly inspired by the ideas of the Enlightenment. Increasingly, the Genoese had to rely on foreign powers to prop up her dwindling international position, in particular France, who used this as an opportunity to compel the seizure of Corsica from the Genoese, and in 1770, Corsica was formally incorporated into the French monarchy. Thereafter, Corsica has always been part of France. Napoleon Bonaparte was born in Corsica amid the backdrop of the French conquest of the island. The ambitions of a free Corsican Republic under Pasquale Paoli were never to be realized, though the French conflict would result in the Bonaparte family, originally the Bonaparte family, essentially of Genoese extraction living in Corsica, to collaborate with the new French administration, earning the internal enmity of one Pasquale Paoli, who would return in 1793 after the deposition of the king and force a young Napoleone, later of course Napoleon, briefly a Corsican nationalist, into French exile. On the eve of the French Revolution, we can see that Italy had already undergone a significant transformation, not just in the family names of the rulers and their taking up Italian residency for the first time, but in the sporadic incorporation of Enlightenment principles and the attack on the church, the early precedent of revolution in Corsica, and in the decline in influence of the papacy. During the Tridentine era, the papacy had been the authority and the source of cultural and religious missionaries reform throughout the Catholic states of Europe. Now the papacy finds itself in a state of siege, with the prospect of invasion by far more radical forces, which will threaten all the established powers of the peninsula. Prior to the war, the revolutionaries in France had seized church property, and in 1791 annexed the Avignon enclave, an ancient possession of the Papal States. Savoy joined the forces of the First Coalition, while French forces annexed both Savoy proper and Nice. By 1793, French forces were on the defensive once more, and Savoy and Nice were liberated by Italian coalition forces. Exploiting the general chaos in France following the Jacobin purge of the Girondists, the government in Paris lost control of Lyon and Toulon. With British naval support, Austria, Naples, and Savoy invaded France, only to be defeated by the armed armies of André Masséna in the Saoggio offensive, assisted by one Brigadier Bonaparte, who had been promoted from lieutenant after his role in the conquest of Toulon to Brigadier General. The central government, whose war strategy was directed by one Lazare Carnot, the organizer of victory, had no interest in an Italian campaign. Now the threat to France itself was defeated. With the coup of Thermidor and the fall of Robespierre, Masséna took the initiative by invading Italy for the first time, reaching Genoa and defeating the coalition forces at De Gaulle. Carnot, who had survived the change in regimes in Paris and was now a director in the new government, resumed his pro-German strategy, or rather his offensive German strategy. As part of Carnot's new campaign against the coalition, Bonaparte, who had risen to General of the Interior following his crush of the insurrection of the 13th Vendémiaire in Paris, would lead a token diversion in Italy, while the main attack thrust went into Germany. Bonaparte was not expected to succeed and owed his position as the commander of the army of Italy to the political influence of Paul Barras, his patron and one of the directors of the new government. The Italian army, after 4 years of neglect and inaction and subsequent illness and desertion, had declined from 100,000 men to around 60,000 men when Bonaparte assumed command in March of 1796. Of those, under 40,000 men were available for an offensive campaign. Bonaparte's plan was to divide the Austrians and Savoyard armies, forcing the latter out of the war, and allowing for the French to mount operations in the Po Valley, directly against Austria in the heart of their power in the Duchy of Milan. With overwhelming numbers, around 70,000 men, and anticipating an attack, the Austrians and their Savoyard allies launched a preemptive strike against the French at Voltri, forcing the French to withdraw. Bonaparte immediately counterattacked at Montenotte, forcing the Austrians into retreat in Bonaparte's first victory of the Italian campaign, with the result that the gap was widened between Austrian and Savoyard forces. The French armies met the Austrians at Dago again before meeting the separate Savoyard armies at Sava. In many of the engagements of April 1796, Bonaparte suffered heavy casualties and compared to his coalition counterparts, and yet his speed and relentless aggression was sufficient in separating the Savoyard armies from the Austrians, allowing Bonaparte to crush the Savoyard army at Mondovi only 12 days into his campaign. Having defeated Savoy and reached the wealthy lands of northern Italy, Bonaparte advanced his army as far into enemy territory as possible before the conclusion of an armistice at Ceresco, which not only took Savoy out of the war, but allowed French armies to garrison forces and pass freely throughout Savoyard territory as far as Valenza and the Po River to the border of Austrian territory, while Savoy proper and Nice were finally recognized as French territories. While Napoleon had concluded his Montenotte campaign, had and of course achieved more than any other commander, including André Masséna, had in the previous 4 years, Bonaparte kept advancing to Piacenza to trap the Austrians in Italy, while potentially severing communications between Milan and Vienna. The Austrians, under Beaulieu, successfully retreated, though suffering heavy casualties at the Napoleonic victories at Fombio and Lodi. Though the Austrian army in Italy survived, it was at the cost of the city of Milan, which fell to Napoleon after the Battle of Lodi. Though the Austrians had lost their political centre in Italy, Bonaparte's conquest was incomplete so long as the Austrians controlled the great fortress of Mantua. At Borgetto, Napoleon was able to separate Beaulieu's army from the fortress garrisons at Mantua, and the siege of Mantua ensued, which would last from June of 1796 until February of 1797. Throughout that time, the Austrians dispatched several relief forces. A major relief was conducted under von Wurmser with the intention of trapping Bonaparte's army between the fortress and the Austrian army. To complete this envelopment, von Wurmser had divided his army, allowing Napoleon to defeat both Austrian armies separately at Lonato and Castiglione, forcing the Austrians to retreat yet again, though at the cost of briefly lifting the siege of Mantua, delaying its conquest by several months. Bonaparte failed to destroy Wurmser's army, chasing it to Trent, before Bonaparte defeated the army at the First Battle of Bassano. Wurmser then made the major blunder of reinforcing the garrison at Mantua. Though Napoleon had failed to destroy the army, they were now trapped in Mantua with its dwindling cache of supplies. The Austrians, faced with the potential loss of both the fortress and the army within, raised a new army under Joseph Alvinci von Borbrek, and though this army was raw and dependent on a large number of Tyrolean irregulars and militiamen, von Borbrek defeated Bonaparte twice at the Second Battle of Bassano and Caldiero, the only defeats Bonaparte suffered during the campaign, and indeed the first defeats that Napoleon would suffer for over the next decade, the only defeats. With the prospect that this third relief effort could end the French campaign in Italy, Napoleon, with heavy losses and personally commanding his men on the front, was able to outflank and defeat the Austrians under von Borbrek at Arcole. Nevertheless, the Austrians were not decisively defeated, and poor cooperation between the Austrian commanders, more than the apparent French strength, convinced a reluctant von Borbrek to retreat. The Austrians reinforced and led a final assault to relieve Mantua at Rivoli, which Bonaparte won decisively. The Battle of Rivoli was the decisive engagement of the campaign that ensured the final defeat of the Austrian army in Italy and the surrender of Mantua. The defeat of the Austrians in Italy wasn't enough for Bonaparte. Jourdan and Carnot's German campaign had failed, and Napoleon's diversionary attack had become the principal theatre of the war. Rather than attack Vienna through Germany, Bonaparte characteristically kept on fighting, kept pushing the initiative, this time focusing on Austria itself and Vienna, reaching Klagenfurt and later Judenburg before the Austrians sued for a general armistice that was followed by the Treaty of Campo Formio later in 1797. With a tentative political balance that had remained in place for centuries, overturned so decisively in a single year, bedlam ensued in Italy as old nations crumbled and new ones were established. Savoy was the first Italian state to become a client of the French following the Montenotte campaign. The Savoyard alliance with France was later betrayed when General Joubert overthrew the tenuous hold of the monarchy there and established a Piedmontese republic in Turin. After abdicating, King Charles Emanuele fled to establish a new base of operations, ultimately in Sardinia. In Milan, no such intermediary existed to facilitate French control in the interim. Indeed, Milan had been the centre of Habsburg power in Italy since the end of the Sforza, and the precedence of earlier French rule under Louis XII and Francis I had been to claim the territory as a personal fief of the French king. As France was now a republic, and yet France had no pretext to annex it, indeed, France had placed Milan under a military administration officiated by Jacobin commissar Salcietti, who crushed any whiff of anti-French sentiment in the city to protect Napoleon's campaign from the rear. With France now victorious in Italy, the French appeal to notions of fraternity and liberation from foreign despotism to justify their occupation of Lombardy. This was the origin of the Cisalpine and the Transpadane republics, which established client constitutional regimes on the former territory of Austrian Lombardy in imitation of the system of government of the French Directory. They were client states in that the French ambassador acted with the powers of a virtual viceroy to oversee the administration, while the territory of the new sister republic was occupied by the French army, and levies were to be drawn of fighting age men from the republics to assist in France's various campaigns. Similarly, a revolt in Genoa had given Napoleon a pretext to enter Genoa and proclaim another French-aligned republic, the Ligurian Republic, once again ending around 1,000 years of Genoese political independence. The Treaty of Campo Formio with Austria gave international recognition for this new order in northern Italy, with special provisions for the territory of the former Venetian Republic. The old territory of Venice, the Terra Firma, had been quite extensive, from the borders with Austria at Friuli to Treviso, Padua, Verona, and the western part of Lombardy, which the Venetians had held since the 15th century. Venice was nominally neutral and without any adequate army or navy to defend itself, as I previously mentioned. The impotence of Venice was demonstrated when both Bonaparte and Austria repeatedly violated Venetian neutrality, with many of the pivotal battles of Napoleon's campaign occurring on nominally Venetian territory. A secret pact with the Austrians was formalized, whereby the Venetian Republic would be partitioned between France and Austria, with the latter acquiring a new border at the Adige River, in addition to acquiring Venice itself and Dalmatia, in compensation for the various French gains throughout Italy. Without the power to resist the partition, the Venetian Republic unconditionally surrendered to Napoleon in May of 1797, again ending 1,000 years of Venetian statehood. While concluding a peace with Austria, Napoleon was anxious to secure the Po estuary and access to the Adriatic through the papal possession of Romagna. In February 1797, Napoleon invaded the region and compelled the Pope to renounce the territory, formally renounce Avignon, and allow the French to confiscate various treasures in papal possession, such as the bronze of Lucius Brutus, the founder of the Roman Republic. Though France was now at peace on the continent, through her treatment of the Papal States, the Republic had signalled its hostile intent for the rest of Italy. Having established an allied and republican government in Milan, why couldn't such a precedent serve as a potential model to be further exported? Indeed, French ambitions in Italy that guaranteed the peace with the First Coalition would inevitably fail on the tide of this revolutionary fervour and the impotence of the Italian states to hold their own against the new French government, the French army. Joseph Bonaparte, now the French ambassador to Rome, together with Brigadier Dufault, arrived in Rome shortly after the annexation of the Romagna, only to hold a republican festival, or rather to incite a republican revolt against Pope Pius VI, which was put down, and Dufault was of course shot. The papacy now found itself in an impossible position. Without Austrian support, the French were at once inciting rebellion against the Pope and using the death of one of their agitators to fabricate a diplomatic incident and a pretext for a French invasion. Rome was occupied within months, and the Roman Republic, modelled on the Cisalpine Republic, was declared in the rump territory of the Papal States, deposing and exiling the Pope and adopting a tricolour in style of the French. The Pope would not renounce control over the territory of Rome and the Papal States, and died soon after. Combined with the French creation of a sister republic, the Helvetic Republic was established in Switzerland, and Napoleon soon after invaded Egypt. The French occupation of Rome drew Naples into a new coalition against Austria. Despite the republican and revolutionary facade, the French regime in Rome, under the army of Berthier and later MacDonald, was attested by the Roman population. The Neapolitan monarchy also was enthusiastically behind an Italian campaign to restore Rome to the Pope and oversee a collapse of French authority in Italy, while Napoleon himself was absent in the Middle East. Nelson arrived in Naples to provide naval support, while the Austrians arrived under Karl Mack to head an army of Neapolitan conscripts to take Rome. Nevertheless, an unanticipated French attack under MacDonald at Valentino sent the coalition army into disarray, despite outnumbering the French 7-1. The Roman campaign bungled. Nelson facilitated the flight of the royal family of Naples to Palermo. With the departure of the king and the imminent arrival of the French armies, the Neapolitan Lazzaroni, the lowest orders, who were also considered the most fervent Bourbon partisans and effective royalist sans-culottes, committed a series of massacres aimed at anyone with French republican sympathies. Fearing reprisals from the Lazzaroni, a group of Neapolitan notables appealed to the French to rescue them and restore order, establishing imitation republican and Jacobin clubs. Championnet arrived in Naples in January of 1799 and proclaimed the Parthenopean Republic after the Greek colony of Parthenope, under the pseudo-headship of one Prince Gennaro Serra. The court in Palermo was organizing to retake Naples under one Cardinal Ruffo, who sparked a royalist uprising in Calabria. Without popular support, the new French-backed republic quickly crumbled outside of Naples, and within Naples, the army took up garrison in the main fortresses, such as St. Elmo and the Castle Nuovo. Supported by the Royal Navy under Nelson and the navies of the Ottomans and the Russians, the Republican government surrendered and many of its members were executed. 8,000 in total were arrested, and I think 100 were executed, including Serra, while the monarchy was restored to Naples. In September of the same year, a second invasion of Rome was mounted, more successful than the first, which retook Rome and enthroned a new pope, Pope Pius VII. Napoleon would not arrive in Europe until September of 1799. During this time, his major gains in Italy were undone by a new coalition. As part of this new coalition, the Russians under Generalissimo Suvorov joined with the Austrians against the French, who were overstretched in attempting to hold Naples, Rome, and Milan. Understanding that the French would soon be outnumbered by the coalition, the French attacked the Austrians under Paul Kray, only to be defeated at Manano, imperiling the Cisalpine Republic, and again they were defeated, the French, by Suvorov at Cassano and Trebia, where Suvorov crushed MacDonald's army before the French forces could be assisted by reinforcements led by Moreau. In the aftermath of Trebia, French garrisons fell across Italy. Capua and Naples were recaptured, and the remnants of the French army under Moreau withdrew to Genoa and Piedmont to prepare for a counterattack, only to be defeated by Suvorov again at the Battle of Novi. In a total reversal of Bonaparte's original campaign, Suvorov was undefeated in Italy, while Mantua was retaken by the Austrians. The remnants of the French army prepared to be besieged in Genoa, where after the coalition command redirected Suvorov away from Italy to defeat the Helvetic Republic in Switzerland, ensuring the survival of a diminished French force in Italy. By 1800, Suvorov had been ordered to withdraw from the war as Tsar Paul dramatically changed Russia's stance in the war to that of neutrality. Nevertheless, despite the loss of Suvorov and the coalition forces under Austria, the coalition forces under Austria outnumbered the remaining French forces 2-1. The Austrians, under the command of Melas, now laid siege to an imperiled French army in Genoa. It was against this backdrop of wholesale French defeat across Italy that Bonaparte, Sieyès, and Roger de Coo launched their coup against the Directory government, and soon after, Bonaparte's coup within a coup established a personal dictatorship with Bonaparte as first consul, ostensibly so that Bonaparte could deliver the Republic from the disastrous War of the Circum coalition in Italy, which now threatened to attack France itself. While Melas was in Genoa, Napoleon imitated Suvorov's crossing of the Alps the previous year before attacking the Austrians from the north through the Alps, retaking Milan and seizing major strategic points across the Po to leave the Austrians cut off in Piedmont. Bonaparte had hoped that Genoa could hold out for long enough for him to complete a full entrapment of the Austrian army. Alas, the French had already surrendered, leaving the Austrians under Melas free to engage Bonaparte. Bonaparte wrongly believed the Austrians to be effectively beaten after a minor engagement between them and Jean Lannes at Montbello. Instead, the Austrians had amassed at Alessandria and planned to attack Bonaparte to reopen their supply lines with Austria. The Austrians attacked Bonaparte at Marengo, which for a moment appeared to be a decisive Austrian victory, until the arrival of the forces of Louis Desailles threw the Austrians into a disordered retreat. And of course, as shown in the image on the right, Desailles himself was killed in that altercation. Despite the bungled nature of Bonaparte's victory at Marengo, the battle proved sufficient to defeat the Austrians in northern Italy, though the War of the Second Coalition on the continent was ended by Moreau's grander victory at Hohenlinden. Bonaparte, as first consul, required a political victory, and so came the myth of Marengo that was transformed into a pivotal moment in French history, a propaganda campaign that attempted to legitimate the consulate and the perpetuation of the Napoleonic power. Despite this, Marengo wasn't even the last major battle fought in Italy for the duration of the revolutionary and Napoleonic periods. After the Treaty of Luneville, which was signed after the Battle of Hohenlinden, Bonaparte would consolidate his grip over mainland Italy. Despite the provisions of the Treaty of Luneville, a return to the situation imposed by Campoformio in the north, over the next decade, Bonaparte, later the Emperor Napoleon, would go on to exceed these provisions, effectively nulled by subsequent wars and victories. Though in contrast to the revolutionary period of 1797 to 1799, Napoleon would use this period of 1800 to 1812 to expand his own personal authority, that of the empire's direct territory, and the possessions of his new imperial dynasty. As part of the treaty, both Modena and Tuscany were awarded to France, and their rulers compensated in Germany, leading to a major compensation effort that would lead to a major reform of the Holy Roman Empire, the topic for the next lecture. The situation in Tuscany cemented the Franco-Spanish alliance, albeit briefly. As compensation for the dissolution of Parma, the House of Bourbon-Farnese was given a new territory out of the old Grand Duchy of Tuscany, the new Kingdom of Etruria, of course Etruria harking back to the old Etruscan period of old ancient Roman history. And this too was to be a French client state, though ruled nominally by a relative of the King of Spain, Louis I of Parma. The Piedmontese Republic, briefly reconstituted after Marengo as the Sub-Alpine Republic, was under French occupation from 1802, during which time all pretense of independence in this sister republic, quote-unquote, was abandoned, as their army was incorporated into the French army, and they even utilized the French currency, the franc, while being effectively administered by France. It should also be noted that the franc wasn't used in other French-Italian territories. Rather, Napoleon tried to establish the lira as the French currency, the first sort of Italian currency in the Italian Republic and later the Kingdom of Italy. The fact that the Savoyard monarch was still free and reigning from Sardinia, and the possibility of a British-backed coup in his favour in Piedmont was used by Bonaparte as a justification to annex part of this territory directly to France, a factor in the resumption of hostilities between Britain and France after the Peace of Amiens, which briefly created a window of peace from 1802 to 1803, despite the fact that from 1792 until 1814, France and Britain were virtually perpetually at war, save for this one tiny break. France had already annexed Savoy and Nice, and the annexation of Piedmont was the first naked example of Napoleon's aggrandizement of France beyond her so-called natural borders or Gallican borders at the Rhine and the Alps. To avoid alienating his Italian clients, Bonaparte awarded some of this territory to the new Republic of Italy, out of the Eastern Republic, Eastern territories of the Subalpine Republic, and the whole former territory of the Cisalpine Republic. It was given a new constitution, this Italian Republic, in imitation of the consulate, with Bonaparte himself serving as president, while French-style département, the metric system, and a National Guard was established based in Milan. Liguria would soon be annexed to France too. When Napoleon was declared Emperor of the French the following year in 1804, Napoleon dissolved the Italian Republic and revived the ancient Italian Kingdom, a title that had fallen into abeyance since Charles V was crowned in the 16th century. To emphasize his connection with his royal Italian predecessors, Bonaparte was crowned in Milan with the Iron Crown of Lombardy, a gold circlet dating supposedly to the era of Alboin and the original Lombard invasion of Italy, and of course his creation of a new Italian state from Pavia, or would later become an Italian state. At that time it was of course a Lombard state. In theory, the constitution of the old Italian Republic was never abolished, and yet the Italian Parliament was never summoned after the coronation, and power was wielded by Viceroy Eugene de Beauharnais, the stepson of Napoleon, the son of Josephine de Beauharnais, and Eugene ruled the state as an effective autocrat, while Italy would send soldiers to form contingents in the Grand Armée. Though the territory of the Italian kingdom would expand, Bonaparte never meant the kingdom to serve as a nation of Italy, with himself leading it in a simple personal union. Rather, the kingdom was confined to the north and east, the Po Valley, the Romagna, and later Ancona. A favourable interpretation would lead to this Napoleonic kingdom acting as some sort of restoration of the old imperial crown of the Carolingians, but there was very little correlation between the historic borders of this ancient imperial kingdom of Italy as part of the Carolingian and Holy Roman Empires and this new territory. Indeed, half of the territory of northern Italy in the west would be annexed to France by 1809. Shortly after Napoleon's coronation, he would participate in the major campaigns of Ulm and Austerlitz, while the Italian army was under the command of Andre, now Marshal Massena, who defeated the Austrians at the Battle of Caldiero near Verona. After Austerlitz, Napoleon would join the Italian territory of Austria in Venetia to his new Kingdom of Italy, while the entirety of the Tyrol was given to France's ally Bavaria before a subsequent territorial revision gave the south of Tyrol to Italy, which is now the modern Trentino. Nevertheless, while the Napoleonic system remained strong in Milan, it should be noted that the new Italian government failed to win over and incorporate various particularist elements, such as the Venetian nobility, who were very hostile to being forced into a Milanese-led state, if anything, bringing back old memories of the Lombard Wars of the 15th century, but also this failure to superimpose a joint Milanese-Venetian administration would have its echo when the Austrians tried to do the same thing in the first half of the 19th century. Naples had been occupied by an Anglo-Russian army to prevent a potential French conquest, yet after Austerlitz, both the Russians and the British quickly withdrew. Quick to exploit the now defenceless Naples, Andre Massena and Joseph Bonaparte invaded, and King Ferdinand fled again to Palermo, while his army waited in Calabria, only to be defeated at the Battle of Campotenese. This time, the Lazzaroni did not rise, and Joseph Bonaparte was installed as the King of Naples. One fortress, Gaeta, held out against Massena. The Neapolitans instead led a general uprising across the kingdom, while the British sent an expeditionary force under John Stuart to assist in this uprising. Nevertheless, Gaeta eventually fell, and the British retreated to Sicily, which held out against the French. The popular uprising against the French continued for a year, amounting to a guerrilla war that would presage the French experience in Spain. Indeed, it should be noted that King Joseph of Naples would later be imposed upon Spain as King Joseph of Spain. In Etruria, Napoleon deposed the Bourbon Parma king, ostensibly so that this king would later be compensated by a French conquest of Portugal that never happened, and instead this served to undermine the Franco-Spanish alliance. Indeed, shortly after, Napoleon would occupy Spain, and Joseph would be replaced as King of Naples by Napoleon's brother-in-law, Murat. While Napoleon had done much to rehabilitate the church in France, his posture came to resemble that of a Caesar or Papist, or the worst aspects of Ghibellinism, intent on denying the Pope's temporal authority. Despite Pius VII's joining of the continental system against Britain, Napoleon first annexed Ancona and then Rome, exiling the Pope while utilizing the imprisonment of various cardinals to coerce the Pope into making more concessions to Napoleon over the management of the Catholic Church in Europe. Combined with Napoleon's possession of the Kingdom of Italy, his temporal possession of Rome, his rescinding of the donations of Pepin as some sort of Charlemagne come again, allowed Napoleon to bestow the courtesy title of the King of Rome upon his new son by Mary Louise, who would briefly rule as Napoleon II. As Napoleon would fall 3 years later, we can never know if Napoleon would have reorientated the centre of his power in Europe from France to Italy. But to say that Napoleon, originally from Corsica, which was then very much part of the Italian cultural sphere, had an affinity with Italy would be an understatement. If anything, due to his Genoese background, Napoleon was again ethnically Italian rather than French, an adopted Frenchman, but an ethnic Italian. After the War of the Fifth Coalition, Napoleon seized the Dalmatian coast, Lienz and Zagreb, to form the Illyrian provinces out of the old Austrian Adriatic coast. Though the status of this territory was never effectively determined, it was never formally incorporated into the department system of France, and therefore we could possibly lean on this idea that Napoleon may have united these territories with Italy, as later demanded by the Italian irredentists when they took over Yugoslavia and Croatia in the Second World War. The Napoleonic settlement in mainland Italy would endure even briefly after the abdication at Fontainebleau, as the northern Italians in particular had remained loyal throughout Napoleon's defeats in northern Europe, all the way from the long retreat out of Russia to the Battle of Leipzig, and of course Napoleon's own retreat into France itself, to such an extent that there was even an abortive campaign to keep Eugene de Beauharnais in power as Napoleon's successor to the title of King of Italy. Indeed, the Italian bureaucracy continued to levy troops and collect taxes, while parts of France were in open revolt, especially around the Pyrenees and Bordeaux and the region in the south, and of course the Vendée. I just want to briefly end on this segment from Brewers, which I brought up at the end of the previous lecture. When the demands of war led to violent resistance, as happened almost everywhere, initially what mattered was a refusal on the parts of certain key sectors in a region to allow these salient manifestations of anti-revolution to develop into a counter-revolution. This usually meant urban centres that were politically unreliable, but could also ultimately impose themselves on the hinterlands with imperial help. In rural areas, where the propertied classes were both influential and loyal, the same pattern could emerge as in parts of Piedmont and latterly Tuscany. Set in this context, Napoleon's attempts to rally the nobility of the West acquires its full significance. The imperative was to deny the popular classes, especially those of the recalcitrant hinterlands, the leadership they needed to sustain resistance. Hence, during the massive rural revolts in central and northern Italy in 1809, the great Italian cities stood by the Kingdom of Italy. In the same year, a revolt against the mobilization of the Royal National Guards and the Tsar was easily isolated and crushed, a fate that had already befallen a revolt in Piacentino in northwestern Italy in 1805-6, which had similar causes. Although these events shocked and even demoralized many local administrators, their ultimate futility, above all their lack of elite leadership and the resumption of normal administration soon after their collapse, showed that the Napoleonic state had struck deep roots in those areas much further outside of the control of even Western and Southwestern France. So the idea is that the Napoleonic state outside of France itself, focusing in on the Italian-run administration, had a deeper connection to the regime of Napoleon than parts of France, such as the Vendée or even southwestern Pyrenees, which had always to some extent been hostile to him. Such power, when it existed, Brewers contends, reinforces the idea that the heart of this Napoleonic empire lay in the forgotten kingdom of Middle Francia that had incorporated northern Italy, though never the Duchy of Benevento, as if to historically mirror Napoleon's own struggles with the Napoleonic, with the Neapolitan insurgency in the south. So here we have history very much repeating itself, a new imperial power establishing itself in Rome, in Lombardy, to a lesser extent Venetia, but definitely around Piedmont, extending through and, of course, ultimately taking up Belgium and the Low Countries and the northeastern section of France, and this being the core of the Napoleonic Empire. That and Napoleon's own desire to place himself as the King of Italy, place his most able his most able relative, Eugene de Beauharnais, as the viceroy of Italy. And that and the fact that Napoleon, again, is this man, if anything, a Francified Italian, the fact that he is occupying both the positions as an Italophile and a Francophile at the same time, while being emperor to both. And then you have stories of Napoleon possibly taking up the Colonial Palace in Rome as his ultimate imperial residence, moving out of the Tuileries and moving out of Fontainebleau to move to Rome. And of course, establishing his son as a king of Rome, as if to indicate a new center of gravity, moving the empire towards Italy. It's interesting to see, had the Napoleonic state been able to consolidate, whether it would have become more French or indeed more Italian, and whether this emphasis on Napoleon being the new Caesar would have been consolidated by his personal occupation and perhaps even direct rule from the city of Rome. And thus we arrive at the culmination of the Napoleonic state in Italy before it is swept away in the aftermath of Napoleon's defeat at Fontainebleau, even though there is a slight echo in Murat's campaign to restore the Kingdom of Naples, which coincided with the Hundred Days campaign, which resulted in Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. All of this occurring at the same time. So there we have it, the French Revolution being exported to Italy. Tomorrow, like I said, I will be focusing on the end of the Holy Roman Empire and exporting the French Revolution to Germany, but that lecture is going to be more periodically condensed to the period from 1780 up until the period of 1812, 1813, when things begin to go horribly wrong to Napoleon. And then, of course, there is a bonus lecture on the Spanish, on the French Peninsula War in Spain, between 1808 and 1813, which is for members only on Sunday, and there will be a discussion on Monday. I want to thank everyone who sent a super chat, but I'm really trying to get into the habit where there is only one super chat reading per episode, and I'd like to do this the last segment of the episode. So this episode is three parts and a bonus part. So thank you everyone for reading, for sending super chats, but I'm going to read them all on Monday, at the end of Monday's discussion. So thank you everyone for listening. Do tune in tomorrow, and if you can also Monday, and of course members tune in on Sunday. Other than that, thank you very much for listening, and good night.